Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Sunil Madhu, who is the CEO and founder of Secure. Sunil, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
So we're going to talk a little digital identity, and I know that that's a topic we're doing a lot of work on together, which is fantastic. But let's dig into some of the specific areas of interest and the topics of conversation circulating on the topic, starting with a conversation we had at the Innovation Project, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that. There's a lot of attention now being focused on the differences between protecting the payment stream and protecting the customer stream. And by that, people mean protecting account data versus really being able to authenticate the identity of that consumer. Obviously, where digital identity and protecting that comes into play. What's your reaction to that as a distinction with respect to strategies when it comes to security and fraud protection in payments today?
There's a lot there. I think we've got to step back and kind of look at the life cycle of fraud. So you can pretty much expect that a customer whose identity has been stolen or whose identity has been synthesized, that's made up basically, that's used to then establish an account, is going to generate fraudulent transactions in general, right? So the first thing you focus on is making sure that the consumer you're onboarding, the consumer you're dealing with, is in fact who they say they are, and stop some fraudulent kind of account opening scenario. And once you've got the account opened, then there's this notion that as time passes by, people might guess the password for the account or the credentials used by the consumer to authenticate themselves before they perform transactions. So in the fraud space, in that life cycle, you kind of look at how do you keep the bad people out and let the good people in? And then how do you ensure on an ongoing basis whether the transactions being performed under that account are actually being performed by the person who is authorized to use the account and not someone who's taken over that account because they've guessed their credentials? And so most solutions, most customers in the market kind of focus on best of breed solutions across both sides of the fence, if you will. Identity verification is important because it assures that the account being established is by the person who claims to be who they are online. And then we look typically at the behavior patterns on that account over time, history, if you will, account history, to figure out passively if the transaction is being performed by the person who opened the account in the first place. And there are different sets of tools in the market for these two different problem spaces, and they're kind of adjacent to each other, but not related to each other. On the one side, for the last, I would say, 50 plus years, new account openings and identity verification was being done through data brokers and credit bureaus who possess a lot of offline information about people in about 14 countries in the world where credit exists. These bureaus and these data brokers have been collecting public information about us from a variety of sources, credit, legal, tax records, etc. And typically when you open up a new account, the information you supply is matched up against the information they have on file about us. And if everything matches, they give the individual a good score and onboard them. And that's kind of not working well anymore for a few reasons. Primarily because all of that data is public to begin with, and more importantly, a lot of the credit bureaus have been breached, like a lot of other companies, and a lot of PII about consumers have been stolen as a result of these breaches. So it costs on average less than $4.50 in the market to go get someone's PII, including things like social security number, bank account details, and so on, in the market. Wow. And fraud as a service is actually a growing problem. So the utility of that data from that perspective has changed, even so much so that prompting consumers for knowledge-based question and answers, you know, which zip code did you live at, is this your previous address, etc., none of that works anymore. The data is so easy to come by. And then more importantly, the demographics of the world has changed. So 51% of the world's population today are millennials, people between the ages of 18 and 34. Those individuals are treated as thin file by these bureaus. There's very little offline information about young people. And those people are also compounded with 50 million adults, for example, in the United States are outside the banking system. And then the problem gets even worse when you look at things through the credit lens and kind of the credit bureau perspective. when you consider that a lot of good people have gone bad from the credit perspective since the housing market collapse and the financial crisis. So there's a very large population of people who are being excluded, who are being rejected in the onboarding flow. And predicting fraud using those traditional kind of patterns of comparison of data doesn't really work effectively anymore. So CURE is addressing that problem uniquely by bringing together online and social data, in addition to that offline data, in order to be able to validate that the individual interacting with that merchant or that financial institution is in fact who they claim to be. As it turns out, it's much more difficult to fake kind of social proof or the network effects of creating friends and people you work alongside, your peers, followers, etc., across hundreds of networks. It's very difficult to recreate that in an artificial way for the fraudster. And looking at through online social data then as an augment to offline data, we're able to discern more accurately if the person interacting with that business is in fact who they claim to be. And we can also do this in markets around the world where credit systems do not exist, and these and offline data is hard to come by. 180 countries around the world where e-commerce takes place, for example. So that's one part of the problem. On the other side of the problem, you look at an existing account for which you've been collecting behavioral information over time, passively. So you might look at the payment behavior of that customer over time, or the devices they typically use to make purchases. Or you might look at their click-full behavior, how they fill the shopping cart before they go fulfillment. And you might look for deviations from those past behaviors as predictors this transaction from this account may not be originating from the person who was authorized to use that account in the account takeover scenario. But increasingly, and we've talked about this a lot, and we've seen this from the industry at the Innovation Project specifically, people are talking about kind of step-up authentication and multi-factor authentication, again, centered around the identity as a way of ensuring that that transaction is from the authorized user. So, for example, if the value of the transaction represented a significant loss to the merchant might introduce a small amount of friction just for that subset of transactions where they may ask the user to authenticate themselves or provide some proof online as simply as possible to prove that it is them in front of that device performing that transaction. And that might be traditionally things like out-of-band messaging, you know, sending an SMS to the device to make sure it's the correct device owned by that user. But increasingly, it's biometrics. So we're looking at, you know, facial features, voice features, and even touch ID and fingerprints, for example, as a way of figuring out that the individual performing the transaction is in fact who they claim to be. Now, looking at biometrics by themselves in a multi-factor step-up authentication flow is insufficient because it is possible for someone to associate their biometric with your PII. And a good example of this is the fraud affecting Apple Pay. As you might have read, Apple Pay has about 6% fraud rate, or 60 times the fraud rate of swipe cards. And you might wonder why, when Apple devices have fingerprint sensors and touch ID, is fraud possible? It's possible because, as a fraudster, they're able to steal our information and convince a financial institution that they are in fact you, and then have the financial institution provision your identity and your credit card details into their mobile wallet, to which they associate their own fingerprint. And so then they can bridge online and offline fraud by wanding their phone through all these retail locations when in fact the charges are being placed on your credit card because your identity has been stolen. So in order to really get the utopic state where we're able to eliminate online transaction fraud or account takeover fraud, you'd have to bind the trusted identity that you verified through a system like ours to that biometric, to that step-up authenticator credentials. And that binding assures you that when those credentials are presented, that there's no way that credential could have been stolen and reused outside of the authorized user. The combination of these two things will ultimately, in my opinion, you know, prevent the need for us to look at things like the devices you're accessing or your payment behavior or your, you know, all these passive behaviors that we try to track and extrapolate from. It'll prevent the need for any of that.
So isn't that what payment tokens are supposed to do?
Well, tokenization deals with a different kind of a problem altogether.
Not what the networks are trying to do with payments. tokens. So the tokenization, you know, on the merchant side is one thing, and the acquiring side. But what the payment tokens are designed to do is to create this method of being able to establish the credential of a cardholder that is kept in a vault that the networks operate. So that's the differentiation in tokenization that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, when people mention tokenization, there are different things. There's tokenization of credentials, and you know, FIDO, for example, is trying to create an interoperable standard for multi-factor or two-factor authentication, U2F, for example, where you can get a token as a proxy for the authenticator credentials. That's one thing. And the other side of tokenization is not having to store the card details on file. Now, traditionally, so I'll talk about the latter first. Traditionally, the card number and the card details have been used as a proxy to identify the customer by merchants. It's just a side effect of making that data available. Many merchants, when they set up their applications in their databases, they keyed off the card number. And the problem with that is that they often didn't encrypt that kind of token. And so when they suffered from data breaches, all of that card data and the PII was stolen by somebody and then used to commit fraud. So tokenization on that side simply means that the card number is not going to be stored anymore. You're going to get a proxy for the card number along with a kind of a one-time use value. That if the data was breached, those proxy tokens cannot be replayed and they're useless to the attacker.
Let's talk about the other side, though, because I think that's
right.
That's where I want to understand better your point of view on that.
Right. So this is what I was talking about earlier when I was talking about identity binding to the credential. Once mm-hmm. you establish a credential, it could be passwords, it could be two-factor authentication, it could be multi-factor authentication with biometrics. What you can do is you can essentially associate in a cryptographic manner the original identity of the individual based on the PII validation and the proofing of that identity to the authentication credentials. The combination of those can be reduced to this cryptographic token. The token can then be passed back to whomever issued it, and assuming that they all conform to a standard, then it can be passed to really anybody. And through some mechanism of federation, that token can be resolved back to the original identity and the authenticators that were bound together to generate that token. And that's what's happening on kind of the what you call payments tokenization. Obviously, I think FIDO is one of the organizations that's trying to do tokenization. There are lots of other private enterprises that come up with their own tokenization schemes. And knowing how slow technology gets adopted in the industry, you're really looking at, you know, the next 15 to 20 years before we move to such a scheme. If you think about it, you know, credit cards were created over several decades ago. So it takes, in essence, decades for these type of schemes to be adapted and used in the market.
Well, it's a fair point. It is, you know, going on 60 years. But I think that, you know, where we're seeing the shift to online, and I want to move to that in a minute, you know, the move to online being driven by mobile, which is forcing this lack of distinction between the offline and the online world, I do think that that will accelerate the intensity of the ecosystem to find a solution that actually can be deployed across channels that isn't device dependent, but that provides another way to authenticate the identity of an individual, which will be digital, because that is the environment
Cool.
that we are now moving towards.
A couple of interesting things to point out there. As we move to strong authentication and biometrics and so on, in any kind of step up or multi-factor mode, it is important to note that there is no standard for any biometric credential. There is no standard algorithm for creating fingerprints or facial recognition prints or voice recognition prints. The technologies for each type of credential itself are proprietary. So when we talk about tokenization, you're first of all trying to get the industry to agree upon a standard for interoperable credentials. And I was part of a company in the early 90s that created identity and access management called Netegracy. The company proposed a standard for something called identity federation back then, called SAML, Secure Assertion Markup Language. The idea was that you could authenticate an individual at one enterprise, and when that individual tried to use a service from another enterprise that had a business relationship with the original enterprise that authenticated that individual. The individual could seamlessly flow from enterprise A to enterprise B without having to be re-challenged for credentials. And the magic happened behind the scenes between these two enterprises in a process called identity federation, where enterprise A that did the authenticating sent enterprise B through a back channel mechanism some data securely that identified that customer to enterprise B, so that enterprise B could implicitly trust that customer and forego the authentication process. Now, we've seen in the last decade that type of technology kind of turn into open ID and open authentication. So the ability to kind of authenticate yourselves in some sort of federated chain already exists. There is no standard for tokenization, however, for the credentials that are bound to the identity, or for that matter, any standards around, you know, what constitutes a trustworthy ID. In the market, the way we've seen it adopted is that you prove out the technology, and when the market adopts that technology to some degree, then the standardization process gets to be much easier. Otherwise, everybody's arguing for their own technology in the standards body. So that's kind of one of the problems. They're creating a common standard for the organization. Then there's the larger problem of binding the trusted identity against an authenticator, against some form of credential, where the biometric credential itself is proprietary. So, you know, there's a lot I think we have to do in terms of solving for both of those problems in order for tokenization to be useful. Now, going back to the first part of your conversation about kind of digital versus, you know, non-digital, the offline versus the digital world. I was reading a report about Amazon's growth recently, and a statistic that was mentioned in the report stood out, that apparently e-commerce only constitutes for about 6% of the entire market share of commerce. So most of the transacting people are doing today is still offline, and there's a lot of room for growth for that to move to the digital world. I agree with you that the adoption of mobile in a lot of different markets will accelerate that growth. But there is still a lot of room to grow. And so this is why I'm saying, you know, it's great that the industry started to recognize the problem and move towards some consensus solution. But optimistically, I think that would take well over a decade or two decades before we see the outcome of that. And in the meantime, we still have to deal with fraud.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that in some merchant categories, there is a much greater penetration of digital commerce to offline commerce. I think, you know, it's an area that we just really don't have our arms wrapped around well, because so much of it is, in some segments, you know, ordering one way and which is online and picking it up offline, and the Census Bureau doesn't know quite how to capture that. So I think, you know, that's another conversation for another day. But let's go back to the kinds of things that you look at when you are trying to validate or help your clients validate an identity, and the social biometrics, the social profile of the individual. Now, you know, a lot of the bureaus have tried to look at social attributes as the way to build the thin files of the consumers you describe into thicker files, and they've determined that that's not necessarily appropriate if you're making a risk assessment for an individual. But I suppose what you're doing is just trying to say that Joe is Joe and Sally is Sally. And for that purpose, social is really effective. Is that the theory of the case?
No, it's actually both. So our products, which are SaaS APIs, use analytical models and big data processing using online social and offline data. We're the first company that's actually successfully created analytical models that have been empirically proven to outperform the models at the top issuing banks, card networks, payment gateway providers, credit bureaus, remittance companies, lenders. And what we're doing is two things in the same product. We are trying to give you a risk assessment as to whether the identity is real or synthetic or stolen and altered. And we're trying to give you a fraud prediction that if you wait some days into the future post the account opening, the net outcome is going to be fraudulent or not. That might sound magical, our ability to do that on day zero when we've never seen the user before and we don't know anything about them and their devices, or we have no history, but we're able to do that really well. One of the things we realized is that when someone steals their identity and they try to use that for fraud, they typically tend to make alterations to that identity. And if you take the altered identity And you project that online, and you try to look at the digital exhaust around that identity, and you look at the network surrounding that identity. One of the first things you'll see is that that is sparse compared to the real person. That's because the real person has a life, and they interact with other people, and that generates the network over time. And the network interacts with that person in very kind of human-like ways because of human psychographics. So the fraudster would have to overcome this problem by, first of all, not only aging profiles, but they'd have to age hundreds of profiles just to vouch for one identity to create a fake network. And more importantly, they'd have to make those aged profiles interact with each other like people interact with each other, which would imply that they would have to create not only a very large network of hundreds of fake profiles on multiple types of social networks, but that those profiles are generated by AI. So they'd have to literally create hundreds of AIs just to vouch for a single profile with which they're attacking. And that is just economically infeasible for the fraudster to do. In fact, if you look at what's happening in the digital underground and aging of social profiles and so on, the fraudsters have figured out that aging a profile and selling that profile does not make any economic sense. For them, they can monetize that fake profile that they've aged over time 100 times over by simply selling the artifacts of that profile. That means if I wanted to buy 10,000 likes for my account, I could pay $5 and get 10,000 likes. And they can take the hundreds of fake profiles they've created and generate, you know, those 10,000 likes 100 times over, 1,000 times over for different people. And so they are able to monetize these profiles differently. And it is creating these profiles and then selling them outright is not part of their model. It doesn't make sense to them.
But I just want to make the distinction between what you're validating, which is that this person is not a criminal, versus this person is credit worthy. There's a difference.
We don't say if they're credit worthy. We do not create credit models in our system. So one of the things we're doing is de-risking the authenticity of the identity, and we're providing a bunch of justification factors so that the human compliance person can actually look at the model and say, yep, the decision is empirical. It is not based on heuristics. The other thing we're doing is making a fraud prediction. And fraud, as you said, is a crime. And fraud varies from one industry to the other. In the merchant space, people care about chargeback fraud. Issuing bank might care about synthetic ID fraud or first-person fraud or third-person fraud. A lender might care about first payment default fraud. There are different types of fraud out there. And what we've been able to do is obtain data from our customers, our financial institutions, and these type of large-scale payments companies, global companies, in terms of who's actually committing fraud in their industry at scale. And that's allowed us to train artificial intelligence, machine learning algorithms, if you will, systems to discern between the features of what people who've committed fraud looks like versus people whose identities have been stolen and then used for fraud, for a variety of different types of fraud. So, for example, we could estimate that an identity has been stolen and altered by virtue of the fact that the combination of PII, personally identifiable information passed to that business by that consumer, doesn't really correlate well. And, you know, we can look at that from an online and social perspective better than we can in an offline perspective because everybody lives online. Everybody has a mobile device. The internet's 25 years old. Everybody has a lot of digital exhaust. We all have connections with other people online. So we're able to ascertain two types of risks there, the authenticity and the fraud risk. And they're two different concepts. Just because you have a young account, just because you opened up an account at that merchant site with a brand new Outlook email address, does not automatically imply that you're a fraudster. You may just have privacy concerns that you establish that account with a young email, for example. So we do not seek to penalize people for privacy behaviors. Those are normal. As human beings, we have the right for privacy. So our system actually takes into account these type of factors and looks at sparse data, data available from different types of networks, from various different websites online, and combines them with the offline PII, and then says, yep, they correlate well, or they don't. And oh, by the way, there's social proof, or there's not. And by the way, the features of these individuals are very similar to features of people who've been reported as having committed fraud by different businesses in that specific industry or vertical. And it is a combination of those things that makes our system effective and empirical.
So if you were to really prescribe the solutions for the digital identity situation that everyone in the ecosystem is facing, which is consumers want to be protected. And what relying parties want to know is that, in fact, that individual identity, you know, isn't spoofed. It is, in fact, the authentic credential being presented by that individual. What is the path that will get us to that solution? I mean, if you say it's going to take 20 years for everyone to agree, I mean, clearly we can't wait 20 years for a solution to evolve. We needed this 5 years ago.
Sure. So the best way to do that is to actually do it. You know, we're a three-year-old company. We have customers in 42 countries using us to prove identities across 180 countries today. And they're primarily tier one and tier two financial institutions. Some of the world's largest remittance companies, biggest payment providers, the card networks are working with us. Several of the bureaus are integrating us. A consortium of the top banks are integrating us. If you look at the Nielsen report, you'll see that 80% of all e-commerce transactions in the United States occurs over 5 issuing banks. We have most of them today in integration path. So, you know, the point being that we've actually shown to the market, we're the first company to actually have done this effectively, because selling to financial institutions is not easy to do, but we've been a mature company to be able to do that. You know, so we've shown the market that our models can outperform theirs. And some of these businesses where we've shown that our models have outperformed by a factor of 3x, have spent several $100 million in sunk costs over 20 years in data scientists and technology to create their models, only to find out that our models blow their models out of the water. And their models look at a variety of different features where we focus on the identity. And so we're actually proving that out. And we expect that as we get adoption in the market in these different countries around the world, that these top banks and these different networks and financial institutions, that regulation will follow, because regulation typically lags behind the market. There is no, for example, standard for know your customer compliance. You just have to prove your technology out. So we intend to do that. We intend to show the world that relying on, you know, credit bureau and kind of offline data is no longer the requirement, that you can create much more empirical models combining a variety of what was once esoteric data in meaningful ways for much better outcomes. And we expect that we'll be able to do that faster than an order of 10 years.
Well, certainly is interesting and a very novel way to put together the complete online, offline picture of a consumer. One more thing before we finish up. Is the application of your technology used mostly to validate the identity of a consumer when they are taking a new action, like opening a new account or bringing themselves into a new environment, into the financial services system, or is this inserted into the payment stream when transactions are happening and you are authenticating that consumer identity related to that particular transaction?
Good question. We're actually used both in both ways. So at the end of the day, a business may be mature enough to have an existing fraud model and fraud system, which we augment. And so typically our outputs from our system are used in that existing, in their existing models as an adjunct, if you will. And the performance of our system is so good that the businesses are ripping out and replacing legacy providers. And in fact, the general trend of the market today is that people are replacing their fraud systems and outsourcing them to SaaS solutions like ours. So we do both. We're used in account openings. We're used in post-account opening scenarios where people change their profile data. For remittance industry, for example, we're used on every transaction because they don't really care about the account opening more than the time when you're sending a payment or remittance. So we're used in both, and our system works very, very fast for what it does to meet these use cases.
Well, Sunil, it's been a fascinating conversation and one that obviously will be continued as this becomes a much greater issue that every aspect of financial services and payments needs to address. I mean, I think the key takeaway from this conversation is that there's a long game and then there's the game today. And we need to be smart about how we play the game today, which will make the long game perhaps not quite as long a game as we might think, because we've solved some of the problems along the way. Well, thanks again for your time and your insights. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Karen, for your time.